Today on the Monocle Weekly, Edition 86, we'll be heading to Brasilia to hear how President Dilma Rousseff's getting on after a little over a month in office.
She is almost absent from the media, very discreet, and I think she's trying to impose a new management style. Less politics, more management.
That was Raul Justelores, business and economics editor at Folha de São Paulo. We'll also be getting a briefing on the next phase of the search for the wreckage of Air France Flight 447.
We're going to spend 3 months, and we are committed to mapping the entire 40 nautical mile circle around that last known position. If the plane's in that circle, we'll find it. I'm very confident of that.
That was David Gallo, director of special projects at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. And later in the program, culture editor Rob Bound talks to artist Jennifer Rubel about her new London exhibition, Engagement.
I think it's a hard thing for people to turn off that part of their brain that has so fully absorbed the lesson not to touch art. In order to complete the piece, you have to interact with it. It doesn't exist outside of that interaction.
And now from London, the Monocle Weekly with Tyler Brulé, Andrew Tuck and Robert Bound.
Hello, it's Sunday, February 13th, 2011, and you're with the Monocle Weekly here in London with me, Tyler Brulé, Andrew Tuck and Robert Bound. Guess what Rob's new title is, Andrew?
I don't know. What is
Rob's? He's the king of cheese. He's the king of... You know, we were skiing last week.
Yes.
Rob was skiing, and I was skiing as well. I didn't go out the first day. But one thing we did find is that Rob can't get down a slope without, I don't know, a small mountain of raclette. Exactly.
Le roi de fromage.
Unbelievable.
I might get that written across my ski jacket,
I think so.
Actually.
Yeah, it was a gorgonzola with polenta. Oof. Actually, if you ski in San Maritz, you know what's quite interesting is that they actually do the polenta on the slope in a cement mixer. I thought we moved to our new office, we'd get a cement mixer maybe out in the parking lot. We get the big polenta scooper.
That would keep the troops happy.
It would.
So you're going to be bringing the fondue party back to London then?
I think so. I think it's time the 70s were relived in, around every civilised dinner table in London, absolutely.
What did you do last weekend, Andrew?
Okay.
What did you dip your fork in?
I didn't have anything like exciting, but it was very annoying because I saw Rob the other day and he's, oh God, yeah, that kind of achy, painy kind of look, and he's like, oh, it's the skiing. You know, oh, I've been down the toboggan. Oh, bugger off. Sorry.
Yeah, Rob's inner thighs were very sore as well.
This wasn't a chafing thing. This was a
it was a muscular issue. Because if you go to this wonderful place called Muertos Morales, and they have you take a funicular up, and then it's about a 15-20 minute ride down at very high speed on sleds, and you can go two by two. You can also go solo. But if you're the back man. This is going to go the wrong direction, I know. But anyway, if you're you have to spread your legs wider, and also I think you're more the key brake person as well, aren't you?
You're very much, you're the sort of tail fin.
Yeah,
you need to get down for aerodynamics, and you need a sort of aerodynamic helmet.
Anyway, Rob had quite a fantastic spill on the last run.
I was rather annoyed. I think that's when you overtook me.
Yeah, and I was. Wasn't a terrific spill, but I just sort of went in my can halfway down on the first run.
But you don't smash your face open or anything?
Well, our colleague Anders, he smashed his hand open last year. He got part of a small tamarack or something through his hand.
That didn't sound good.
His hand.
I'm glad you didn't tell me about that before on the sledge, only afterwards.
Actually, it's a little story, but the guy who was our photographer who was with us at Christmas, he slipped in Marylebone train station and slit his throat open, his chin open. So it's more dangerous, actually, in Marylebone train station than going down the toboggan run, you see.
It's a jungle sometimes.
It is. Anyway, thank God we're almost moving. And I guess, I've also got a little surprise.
What's a little surprise?
I know. You like surprises, don't you? I just got to reach down.
Is this a sound? Are we going to have a sound effect?
Look what I have. Oh, I've got a new issue.
Where'd you get that?
Jackie.
Oh, really? Yeah. You know people, I think.
I do. I know people in this magazine. This is our fourth anniversary issue. Happy anniversary.
Happy birthday.
Happy anniversary.
I'll let the editor look at it first.
That's lovely.
Yeah, I'm very pleased.
Very good. Yeah. Well, that's what happens if you're not in the office for a couple of hours, you see, and then you sneak
all kinds
in.
Of things happen.
The world turns.
Also, I should mention to all of our regular listeners and new listeners as well that in the March issue, there's also it's the second time that we've done a reader survey, and we have a wonderful gift that that we've selected. So someone gets a set of Porter luggage. Porter times Monocle luggage. If we sort of
Sorry,
no. That's how heavy it is.
Yeah,
I like the sound effects.
Can I just say I like this as well? We have the ping of the rubber band as well.
Yeah.
That's the new Monocle travel series.
Yes. So this issue sees the premiere. I think we mentioned it, that we're doing Taiwan is the first stop with our travel guides as well.
There's a lot of jungle in Taiwan.
There is, not a lot of absolutely. People know that. Yeah. And yeah, anyway, well, you can look through it later.
Well, I might look through it while you're in... I'm going to stay focused.
Okay, what we can do is every segment of the program, we can have a little sort of chat about something else you like in the issue.
Okay.
And we should probably start with Section A anyway, because a little over a month ago, Dilma Rousseff was sworn in as Brazil's 36th president, facing the immediate challenges of mudslides and flash floods in Rio de Janeiro, preparing the country's infrastructure ahead of the 2014 World Cup and the 2016 Olympic Games, and filling the very, very, very big shoes of her predecessor, President Lula da Silva, who left office with approval ratings hovering around 87%. So how is her administration faring so far, and is she living up to her Iron Lady nickname? Raul Justolores is business and economics editor at Folha de São Paulo, and he joins us on the line from Brasilia.
Hello, how are you?
Well, we wanted to just check in with you because I guess it's a little over a month in office for Dilma Rousseff, and if you had to give her a grade right now, somewhere between an A to a D. How is she doing?
By far, I think she has changed a lot the style of doing politics in Brazil. I mean, it's a big change from Lula. I mean, she's almost absent from the media, very discreet, and I think she's trying to impose a new management style. I mean, less politics, more management. I think some people certainly is missing Lula's flamboyant style, but I do think that many people are welcoming this seriousness, discretion, action of Dilma working. I think measures are being taken quite fast. I think it's a welcome change so far.
So you're giving her a B so far?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. Do you think that, I guess, you know, to the casual observer, is she behaving a little bit more like a CEO almost, who's come in and, you know, has taken on obviously a very healthy business, but is trying to give it a bit of structure to take it, whether to take it public or to certainly, you know, give it, you know, more universal appeal?
Yes, totally. I think, I mean, first of all, she is trying to protect herself from Brazilian politics. I mean, she doesn't have too much of experience in dealing with other political parties, congressmen that are always trying to get some business to their cities, to their companies, lobbyists, etc. So she's protecting herself from this kind of pressure that she's not so used to. On the other hand, we know that Brazil is preparing itself to host the football World Cup, the Olympics. So she's trying to give some signs that she will get things done. I mean, in just 1 month, she's discussing a lot about airports, about private concessions to run terminals in airports. So I think some taboos of Brazilian government inviting the private sector to run public infrastructure, they are starting to change. And I think that's a welcome idea. I think she likes to be seen as a CEO. I mean, she doesn't have great oratory skills. We know that. She is a little bit shy, I would say. And unlike Lula, she doesn't enjoy so much the stage. I mean, Lula loved to travel, for example, to go to international summits. While Dilma, so far, she had one trip to Argentina in January, and she's going to host Obama, the American president, in March. But her international agenda so far is pretty modest.
So it sounds like the new planes that they bought from Embraer are quite quiet then.
Yes, totally, totally.
I wanted to, if we think of her as a CEO, then could we perhaps argue that she's not very marketing-minded? Because, I mean, you know, as you said, I mean, the flamboyance, you know, good or bad, that certainly Lula was out on the global stage. She was always outselling brand Brazil. Do you think it's all right for a period with of course, major world events coming up? You know, of course, as you said, World Cup, Olympics coming up as well, that Brazil can go quiet on the marketing side? Or do you think she needs to be a bit careful and also hit the road, or at least do something in terms of keeping the brand alive?
Yeah, I think that's a big question mark, because nobody knows how much she has changed from this minister always in the backstage to be a president of an emerging country. I think internally, domestically speaking, I think this idea of being much less flamboyant than Lula is marketing already. I think she knows that she can't compete with Lula in flamboyance, so she'll try to impress the public opinion, especially the middle classes, showing that she's a tough manager. And everybody knows that she can be very tough. But in the international arena, I mean, she doesn't have so much experience on that. So probably she will rely on the Minister of Foreign Affairs, the most experienced people around her. But I think nobody knows, probably she doesn't know how she's going to act outside. Although she has an amazing biography, I mean, she was in jail and tortured under the military dictatorship. She's the first woman to be president of a gigantic country as Brazil. But I mean, she doesn't have experience, so probably she needs to rehearse. I agree with you that, I mean, Brazil needs to have probably a more outspoken president in the following years. But I mean, like China, I mean, they have Hu Jintao, and they are not doing particularly bad. So, and I do think that Dilma can be more outspoken than Hu Jintao, of course.
Raul, it's Andrew here in the studio as well. I just wanted to ask you, what's Lula actually doing now he's disappeared from the stage? Has he managed to keep his mouth shut, or has he disappeared and gone quiet, or is he still kind of commenting from the sidelines?
Probably he's suffering a lot because he loves to be surrounded and hugged by people. He's a bigger-than-life character. But I do think that Lula, probably in 1 or 2 months, he will return. I can't imagine Lula at 63 years old to become a retired former president. I do think that he will try to create a new political space for him, but I mean, nobody knows how will be the relationship between Dilma and Lula. I mean, so far, they are still good friends.
Well, Raul, we're going to check in with you probably at the 100-day mark again to see if, if Dilma's going to advance beyond a B.
Yes.
Excellent. We'll talk to you very soon. Raul Gestalores, business and economics editor at Folha de São Paulo. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. We're back in a moment. You're back with The Monocle Weekly here in London. Last week, France announced that phase 4 of the search for the wreckage of Air France Flight 447, which crashed over the Atlantic in June 2009, will begin in mid-March. Investigators will focus on the 37-kilometre circle surrounding the last known position of the aircraft and use technology designed and operated by the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. David Gallo is Director of Special Projects at the Institute, and he joins us on the line from Woods Hole in Massachusetts. Hello, David.
Good day. How are you?
Good, thank you. I wanted to start, how long has the institution been involved with this project? Were you contacted shortly after the crash in 2009, or have you come on board quite recently?
We had discussions with the BEA, which is the French agency responsible, shortly after the accident itself, but we were only actually involved on scene in 2010. So shortly after the accident, our involvement, we offered assistance and said we would like to become involved. And then about a year later, we actually were out on site.
I mean, given that, of course, this has had an extraordinary amount of attention, obviously, you know, certainly around the time of the crash. It's also a story which has also fallen away from the headlines. And it's only, you know, quite literally sort of cropped up every time there's been another search effort. Does it become more difficult the more time goes on? Because obviously, one would imagine that with almost 2 years past, I would imagine that the black boxes would have stopped sending out a signal. So at this point, you're only looking for pieces of a fuselage. So in one way, does time really matter, given the span that we're looking at?
Oh, I think time matters. I think it matters because for the sake of the flying public, for the aviation industry, but also more importantly for the families and loved ones of the victims. And I just met with some of them recently in Paris, and we're very motivated, more so than ever, to get back out there and find this aircraft. In terms of the black boxes, the flight recorders, certainly the pinging has stopped, but we have every bit of confidence that the data will be on those in those computer memories, and the similar confidence in our ability to find the fuselage and ultimately to find those two recorders.
The point of motivation, and it's interesting that you mentioned that, and even from the perspective of your institution, that you actually went and met the families. This is, I shouldn't say it's surprising, but it's quite interesting to hear that one would think that you would be perhaps quite removed and that you would only be perhaps interfacing just with the BEA and really not talking certainly to the families of the victims.
Sure, that's one way to put it. But you can't, we're human, and you cannot remove yourself from this tragedy that this aircraft just fell out of the sky, and that we do have the technologies and the experience in working in those terrains. I think there's no better team and no better technology available, so we are compelled to do that. And yes, you know, we've been involved with Titanic. We've been involved with the forensic study of the Derbyshire, which was a European Union ship that sank, I believe, in the 80s. But this one has special significance because of there are 228 people on board. And, you know, it's difficult to talk to the representatives of the families without feeling very emotional about what they've gone through. So, and, you know, any sacrifice that we have ourselves to be leaving our families and loved ones behind for a few months pales in comparison to what these people have gone through.
Can you tell us what happens in the weeks to come? Is this about just going over pockets that might have been missed? But certainly for the layman, for the listener, what happens at this point?
Sure. The initial search area was a 40 nautical mile circle drawn around the last known position. And then in that search area, we were focusing on the northwest quadrant because of what we would call retro drift calculations, looking at the bodies and objects that were recovered on the surface and then backtracking them to a spot on the ocean floor. We did that search. There was no evidence of the aircraft in that area. So now we're moving, our goal now, and through the BEA's guidance and with funding from Air France and Airbus, our intent is to survey the entire 40 nautical mile circle to complete that whole area. So we've done about 7,000 square kilometers has been done already, and we've got about 10,000 square kilometers to go. So it's a bigger area, actually. We will go back, by the way, and look at some areas that we were curious about. We'll go back and have a peek.
And what's involved equipment-wise? Does this mean that Woods Hole is chartering a vessel? Do you have your own vessels? And, you know, again, it would be interesting just to hear, you know, what are the, obviously they're not basic tools, but what are the essential tools that you use when you're doing the search?
Sure. Yeah, well, you do need a capable ship. And we are chartering a vessel this time called the Alusha, which has a history as a French oceanographic ship called the Nadir. So we're chartering that ship, which is any moment now we'll be leaving from Seattle, Washington, with our vehicles. Our vehicles are on board already, and we'll be heading through the Panama Canal to Brazil. It'll arrive in March. So you need a capable ship that's capable of being home to, in this case, three robotic vehicles, which is a lot. I mean, it's very rarely done that you have two vehicles, and we have three in this case. So the back of that ship, the Fantail, will be almost like a underwater, it'd be like an aircraft carrier with vehicles coming and going, being launched and recovered, downloading data, up, recharging batteries. It's around-the-clock operation. The vehicles we're using three autonomous underwater vehicles that look like torpedoes. Basically, they are torpedoes that carry both sonar for search and cameras to verify targets on the bottom. And those are state-of-the-art. They're designed to go deep and hug the terrain and to fly very specific patterns across the seafloor. So, you know, in terms of the technologies, this is one of the most sophisticated and intensive searches ever done.
It's Andrew here, also in the studio with Tyler. Just a couple of interesting things I want to know is there a kind of a window at which you can be doing this search? You know, is there other times when the sea is just too rough or the weather is just, you know, too dangerous for you to be out there? And how many people do you actually have on the ship, and how many people are kind of coordinating this from the coast?
Sure. The sea surface there, the atmosphere, because it's the intertropical convergence zone, the ITCZ, always turbulent. The sea, not so bad. The sea is fairly mild. For instance, in Titanic, three times we had to pull up our operation and run for Newfoundland because of hurricanes. Not so the case here. We're very comfortable with the sea state. Although it rains quite a bit, it's just not so bad. The currents are very complicated. It was part of the problem with the retro drift is that the currents are swirling on a very small scale, so it's tough to backtrack anything more than a few days. On the ship, we'll have a total of about 30 people. Some of that is crew, about half is crew of the ship. The rest will be maybe 12 plus will be on the robotic team. And as I mentioned before, it's a 24-hour day operation nonstop. So
for 30 days, it's go, go, go. And that team, those 12 people, will be busy. We'll have probably observers from the BEA, which is the French authority, maybe the French judicial system, because it is an investigation, maybe Air France and Airbus. So we'll have a few observers on board as well. But it'll be a fairly packed ship.
Is there a sense from Airbus, this aircraft hit the Atlantic, how much you will find? And is it just a recovery operation of the black boxes, or will they be looking to also bring up as much of the aircraft as possible?
Yeah, I think the phase that we're involved in is simply to find the aircraft and then to define the debris field. So once we locate the piece of the aircraft, then we go into a different mode, which means that we pull in all the vehicles instead of to go wide area searching. We'll be pulling them into a tight area. We'll fly lower, higher resolution sonars, lots of cameras. We want to know exactly where everything is, even down to the size of shoebox on the seafloor in those areas. So, and then the BEA will go immediately into what they call phase five, which is to get a ship out there, and they'll have several ready with a robot capable of retrieving bits of hull or the flight recorders.
This is not to, pass comment on any of the previous searches that have gone on, but, are you surprised? And I think, when everyone, simply sits on an Airbus today, they can see pretty much, in real time where they are on a screen in the seat in front of them. Are you surprised that, this is now sort of the fourth search you've been called in at this point, that it's been this involved, in an era of such advanced technology and certainly with so much, geopositioning material seemingly at the disposal of everyone, that people have been unable to find this aircraft?
It is not surprising to us that the plane hasn't been found yet. The mountains are very rugged. We were relying a lot on the ability of reverse drift calculations to at least put us in the right haystack. And then we'll find the needle. Now, what we know now is that the needle is not in one piece. It's broken up, so it's pieces of needle. And in fact, the haystack, I think we've got the right one, but it's much bigger than we thought. So it's not surprising to me that it's taken so long. I just hope that this time we're going to spend 3 months and we are committed to mapping the entire 40 nautical mile circle around that last known position. As I said early on, the other teams are extremely motivated to get out there and to get the job done. So if the plane's in that circle, we'll find it. I'm very confident of that.
David Gallo from Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, thanks very much and best of luck.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you. Andrew, Rob, it's when you listen to that story, it's and I have to just go back to the point that it's amazing that someone from the institution actually does go out to meet the families. It was actually sort of quite just going and doing that interview. You didn't sort of think that suddenly you sort of launch back into the very human side of it.
Yeah, amazing. And amazing, him talking about kind of leaving your own families behind for a couple of months while you kind of head off, that sacrifice being small in comparison to what other people have gone through. And it is strange because you normally do think of these people as being quite cold and clinical. And I imagine in some senses they have to be, because I guess when they get down to the wreckage, there's still kind of, remains of the people who were on the plane and things. So it's extraordinary his connection with it. I thought it was heartwarming.
I suppose it's added and very specific motivation for doing that job as well, having to go and see the people that have been affected by it.
Well, that's what he said. I mean, that is very interesting to hear that motivated more than ever. You also sort of wonder, certainly for an institution like this, that there are reputational issues as well, and how sure they are. Because interesting, he talks about, we know the haystack, it's considerably bigger than we thought it was, but do they know where that needle is? And almost whether you take a project like this on, in fact.
And it's also interesting, I thought, that you have these observers on from all of the kind of, all of the players in a way, because as you say, it's interesting how this plays out, because I guess potentially, not just in this case, in any of these cases, there's a chance that that the survivors or the survivors' families rather may want to sue, or there could be legal action. So it's interesting that their role on that ship and knowing what's unfolding and what it turns up.
And I think some of the things that we've heard as well, that if you talk about national brands, etc., of course Airbus, not solely a French brand, but certainly a joint venture between many European nations, but then also Air France as well, that there is a reputational issue for two of the biggest companies in France if things point in the wrong direction for that airline as well.
Yeah, and that's why I guess, of course, they'll be relieved and from a scientific point of view to find out what happened with the black box. But yes, it's going to point some fingers in one direction or another about culpability in this.
You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. We're back after this. back with the Monocle Weekly in London, where it's time to hear from the König of Käse.
Oh, I like what you've done there.
You like that, don't you?
Le roi de fromage.
Yes.
Do you know what it is in Romanche?
I don't know what it's in Romanche.
No one knows what it is in Romanche.
But Rob Bound is here. You like a bit of Romanche, don't you?
I do like a bit of Romanche. Yeah.
We went out dancing as well, Andrew.
To Romanche music?
No, it wasn't Romanche music. No. But it was a bit of a buffet of different tunes.
A bit of a buffet of different styles at the Dracula Club.
Absolutely. With our good friend Rolf Sachs and many others. And it was very nice.
It was excellent.
Are you going to play anything from the dance floor right now?
This is something that might pass the denizens of the Dracula Club by. It might be. I think the latest song we heard, or the most recent song we heard, was Duran Duran that night. that's what gets them going. We're going to listen to something from Denmark, a new band from Denmark called Tree Fight for Sunlight. Quite a nice name, isn't it?
And is there a single attached to this?
There is a single attached to it. The song is called Facing the Sun.
Called again?
Tree Fight for Sunlight.
I liked it.
Yeah, it's cool.
Yeah.
It's quite jolly. There's a bit of sort of, there's a few African rhythms in it. It's a bit Vampire Weekend-y.
I missed that bit, but anyway.
In some of the other songs.
Okay.
Available on the record.
Okay. Andrew?
Well, I just wonder when the people who work at Stadia, will they get a bit fed up with these bands with very long names when they have to kind of slot all the letters in? What happened to the Who, they think?
What happened to Aha?
Jam. They liked it in those days. There were just three letters to put in.
Jam. It's not a shop. What's on tonight, Jam?
Who?
Tree Five Sunlight is almost a Genesis lyric, I think.
Are you going to be shoving that cassette into your dashboard?
I think there's one already stuck in there, so I can't...
tape everywhere in that car.
Is there tape everywhere?
Yeah.
Why do cars still have tape players?
Do they?
They do.
Well, no, do they?
Yeah, I know, but cars have just about caught up with the CD. They haven't caught up with kind of iPod generation yet.
Some have.
You're listening to Jeremy Clarkson on...
Exactly. I think we better stay away from this territory. We're going to keep this segment short today. Because you actually have two segments today. Do you want to billboard what's coming up next after the break?
Earlier this week, I went to interview Jennifer Rubel, who featured on a Bloomberg film about art balls on Miami Beach. And she's got a show in London called Engagement, which is a wry take on the royal wedding, where you can be the star, you can be Kate.
Excellent. Well, we'll hear more about that after this. You'll see the Monocle Weekly in London, back in a moment. Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly. This week, American artist Jennifer Rubel's first solo exhibition in the UK opened in the Stephen Friedman Gallery here in London. Entitled Engagement, the exhibition invites viewers to interact with a life-size sculpture of Prince William to recreate the already iconic imagery surrounding the recent announcement of the royal engagement. Earlier this week, our culture editor, Rob Bound, met with the artist.
So, Jennifer, we're standing in front of a pretty well-known personage. I wonder whether you could talk us through engagement. What do we see in front of us?
I was on a plane going from New York to Miami in advance of Art Basel, Miami. And Stephen Friedman had already asked me to do a show at his gallery in London. And I was thinking about exactly what I wanted to do for that. Just that week, Prince William and Kate Middleton had announced their engagement. And I knew I would do a piece around that subject. I myself have been engaged 3 times. It's a subject of endless fascination to me. And to have a really iconic public figure literally embody the Prince Charming fantasy was just too good to pass up for me. So that's how it began, me sitting on a plane, reading every garbage magazine that exists. And then I started looking at the photo. And the photo is shocking because he really feels like a statue. And then she feels like a human interacting with the statue. And I thought about making that explicit. And then all of my work always deals with some kind of interactivity. And so I thought about how to bring people into this work to make them not intimidated by a sculpture. And the ring became the means of inviting the public to interact with it. So
there's a kind of double sense of double meaning with the engagement and the public engaging with something that's normally very static and something that's on a plinth and something that is, I guess, removed from people's lives, which is sculpture. So it's, I guess there's a double meaning in the title.
Yeah, you know, I grew up inside of a very intense contemporary art collecting family, and I always feel like I would have been an artist really early on if I hadn't known so many great artists through my family and been so intimidated to even go down that path. So for me, undermining the holiness of art is not just sort of some abstract desire, it's a kind of survival tactic for me. In order for me to make work, I need to in some way undermine the authority of great art and great artists. And the way I always do that is to give other people what I never got to have, which is to be able to interact with art in a way that's totally personal and physical.
And I suppose there's an idea of undermining sculpture. A lot of people think that sculpture has to be a huge piece of marble by someone French. I guess this is, you know, something that people can interact with. Are you encouraging people to have their photograph taken while they interact with this sculpture? Is it going to be that sort of interactive and keepsake?
Well, the sculpture is the combination of a close to exact wax facsimile of Prince William, sculpted by, in fact, a French sculptor, Daniel Drouet, and the plinth that it's on, which is a 9-inch white plinth, and people interacting with the Prince William sculpture. So in order to complete the piece, you have to interact with it. It doesn't exist outside of that interaction. I think it's a hard thing for people to turn off that part of their brain that has so fully absorbed the lesson not to touch art. It's anybody who interacts with art from an early age, that's the first thing that they're taught is not to touch art. Before they're taught that art can convey meaning or feeling or emotion or ideas, they're taught not to touch it. It's one of the central frames around artwork.
And there are other works at the gallery today and through the run of the show that riff on the idea of empire and of royalty as well. There's a canvas, or there's a canvas in one of the rooms here that's the same size as the canvas that sat beside William and Kate for that photo shoot. What are these paintings about?
Well, you know, like as a kind of dumb American, I saw the engagement announcement and I saw this giant painting hanging above them, and of course I had no idea who it was, and it turns out to be William IV. I had to research to find out if when William becomes king, he'll be William V. Of course he will. And so that level of staged photograph, which is, it's actually a huge part of our culture today, that photographs are highly staged, highly orchestrated, so that they resonate on an obvious level, on a subliminal level, and visually. But when I learned that, I really wanted to deal with the presence of art inside of that engagement announcement. It was very important that artwork was a part of that. And so I created these drinking paintings, which are just raw blank canvas, exactly the size of the painting that was hanging above William and Kate at the announcement. And coming out of each painting is a single spigot. And you press down on that spigot. Well, first you take a paper cup from the wall, and then you press down on the spigot, and out comes one of five liquors associated with the British Empire. So there's rum, sloe gin, Madeira, Irish whiskey.
So it's going to be a good opening then.
Well, it's not just going to be a good opening, but those drinking paintings will be full and functional for the entire month-long run of the show. So, you know, if you work in the neighborhood, you can come in for a little morning sip.
And going back to the sculpture itself of William, people are encouraged to stand next to him, slot their arm through his, assume Kate's pose for that photo shoot. There is a sort of trashy magazine element to it, and there's a kind of gossip magazine element to that, putting yourself in the princess's shoes. What went through your mind when you first did it yourself, when you first tested out the dimensions of the sculpture and you next to it? How do you feel? Do you feel like a princess?
You know, I mean, I think it's sort of like the dirty secret of women who grew up as feminists or as the daughters of feminists, or, I mean, practically everybody alive now, feminism has touched their lives very strongly. And the dirty secret is you still have this fantasy of a Prince Charming who comes along and makes your whole life wonderful. And I wanted to validate that fantasy and to not beat myself up for having that fantasy. And the truth is, when I, or every woman I've seen, stands up on the plinth and slips her finger through that ring, it's like you get this sudden kind of like giddy, kind of embarrassed, sort of excited feeling. And I think it's very much a part of being a woman that was undermined by feminism. There was a feeling that you couldn't find power or strength while still having those feelings. And I mean, the thing about this sculpture is it's a really powerful, intense sculpture made by a woman. And to give those feelings to women, it doesn't actually disempower you. It disempowers you more to think you have to hide them.
And the sculpture is in a white cube of a gallery space. Obviously, the announcement was done in a very brocaded, sort of rococo kind of royal room, gilt-edged room. How different does William feel outside of that sort of a very lush context? Is he meant to feel different?
Well, I mean, I've never met William. And at this point, I don't think I ever will. But I don't know. You know, for me, it's a distillation. So I'm distilling the key component of that moment and almost erasing everything around it, including Kate. You know, it's taking the part of that moment that for me had tremendous emotional and visual resonance and using that for my purposes in the kind of space where I create work.
Fantastic. All right, Jennifer Bell, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Culture to Rob Bound, who's still here in studio. Everyone should run down and see it.
Yeah, I mean,
do you think this is actually going to, you know, aside from, of course, you know, big day coming up, do you think this has become a bit of an attraction in its own right?
Definitely. I mean, there's a lot of buzz around the opening earlier this week. It was good. It was a very good party, very good dinner afterwards. The drinking paintings went down a storm. Lots of people
were
drinking.
Were they busy throughout?
Yeah, because it's funny, when I actually went to the gallery.
Is there a sponsor attached?
There is not a sponsor attached.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Because it's not going to be cheap.
No.
Because it runs till when?
I think it's all month. I think it runs until...
it's not up until the wedding day.
It runs until the 5th of March, I think. It's always good when the art is the drink itself. That always is a good excuse to have a few drinks at the opening.
I like the word spigot as well. It's a good word, spigot.
Yeah, you don't hear spigot a lot.
Spigot, no. I was thinking maybe you should say faucet.
But I want to get back from our next tour. We'll go down and have a drink.
Yeah, we'll go down and have a drink. You can be Kate.
I can, absolutely. We can all do it together as a foursome. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly, and the Stephen Friedman Gallery runs Jennifer Rubel's show until the 5th of March. We're back after this. Welcome back to The Monocle Weekly, where it's time for this week's monologue. Here's our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, on why questionable governments should approach public squares with caution.
Every revolution has its square. The Czechs gathered in Wenceslas Square. The Ukrainians camped out in Independence Square. And for the Lebanese, it was Martyrs Square. Over the past few weeks, Tahrir Square, in the heart of Cairo, has been the epicentre of Egypt's uprising. Hundreds of thousands of Egyptians from all walks of life have come to Tahrir, Arabic for liberation, to call for the regime's demise. That the protesters chose Tahrir as the base for their protest is no surprise. Named after the Egyptian Revolution in 1952, it has been the setting of numerous demonstrations throughout the past 60 years. It's big, it's central, and it has history. Protesters all around the world have always gathered in squares. Part of it is simple logistics. You want to gather a big crowd? Meet in a big square. But far more important is the sense of power it can generate. Armies, police, and presidential guards have quivered at the sight and sound of a sea of unarmed citizens. Governments, too, understand the power of the square. Witness the displays of military might by the Soviet Union, China, and now North Korea, parading their tanks, jets, and perfectly coordinated marching men through Red Square or Kim Il-sung Square. And governments also understand the peril of losing control of the square. During Kenya's post-election violence in 2008, the country's feared paramilitary police blocked off access to Uhuru Park, the nearest Nairobi has to a central square, for almost 2 months. The moment a political agreement was forged and the government was safe, the park was reopened. In Romania, during the wave of revolutions across Eastern Europe in the 1980s, the moment Nicolae Ceaușescu knew the game was up was when the 100,000-strong crowd gathered in Palace Square began to turn on him mid-speech. Even if protests in squares don't lead to revolutions, they can bring about changes. The Peterloo Massacre in 1819, when the British cavalry charged into a crowd of 60,000 pro-democracy demonstrators in Manchester's St Peter's Field, paved the way for the first Reform Act 13 years later, which gave working men the vote for the first time. And while the most famous protest in a square ended in failure, the mere mention of Beijing's Tiananmen Square remains so potent that Chinese search engines still block out all internet references to it more than two decades on. The protesters in Takrir appear to be in for the long haul. They've erected tents, pulled together barricades, and arranged a supply of food and water. There were many events that led to these protests. The death of an activist in June, the collapse of the regime in neighbouring Tunisia. But without a square to congregate in, to rally in, to protest in, Egypt's unfinished revolution would probably never have started. For Monocle, this is Steve Bloomfield.
A little foreign editor is good, isn't he, Andrew?
Yeah, I like that.
Always interesting. He's a good reader.
He is very good.
Yeah.
He should do more radio, shouldn't he?
He definitely should.
We should keep him away from TV, though.
God damn it.
Excuse me. Oh, God. Did I tell you at the top of the show I've got a bit of a cold?
Oh, it's a bit late to introduce it now.
Well, I know, but just in case people were wondering. I don't have a cough button. That's what I like.
You do need a cough button.
I like... It's interesting. Well, when we build our studio, it's an NPR thing, because when we were at NPR in Washington and also in Los Angeles and in New York, we had a cough button in all those studios.
I think
American presenters are more sickly?
Yeah.
What does that say?
I don't know. Maybe it harks back to the days of, you know, when you could smoke in your radio studio and, you know, night fly style, and you needed to quick cough.
Yeah. Andrew, what are you doing next week?
I've got a couple of days in Switzerland.
Right.
Seeing...
late.
I'm going skiing. Pick up the last bits of cheese out the bowl. No. I'm going for work. Work, not for okay. play.
I forgot to mention that was actually one of the musical highlights of the trip. Were the men who were yodeling at dinner?
That was excellent.
It was a sort of a casual sort of romance Friday night dinner, and a man started yodeling at the back of the room.
Oh, you've done that a few times, haven't you, Rob? We've been out as well.
Do you mean that? That's a thinly veiled metaphor for something else, isn't it? I don't quite know what you mean.
No. Okay, so you're in Switzerland. Rob, where are you?
Well, I'm unfortunately not going to have a week where I'm actually not going skiing.
Okay. No, exactly.
I'll be testing out the
new dairy section of Waitrose.
Yeah, exactly. I'll be down the Neil's Yard Dairy.
Okay.
Moving.
Guess where I'm going to be?
Where are you going to
be? I'm going to be in Honolulu.
You're all over the place.
I am.
Yeah, this is good.
And you're going to be moving. You're going to be moving to new offices, I think.
So you're going to be slipping off your salopettes and slipping on your speedos.
Something like that. He's working on that old program.
Yeah,
I like a bit of alliteration every now and then. It cheers me up.
He's got it written on his hand.
Mm-hmm. That's all for this week's edition of the Monocle Weekly. Today's show is produced by Alex Mills, and our sound engineer was Chris Sharp. If you have any thoughts or comments for today's show, then do drop us a note to weekly@monocle.com. And remember, you can catch up with us daily via our monocolumn on our site, and also, for the moment anyway, catch us on our new TV program, newish TV program on Bloomberg Television, or via Monocle, or it's also on Bloomberg site as well. Next week, I'm going to be coming to you from where?
Honolulu.
Nope, Seoul. Got to keep up. I'm going to be traveling with Hugo McDonald.
Yeah. Is he carrying your bags?
Probably. Anyway, for now, I'm Tyler Brulé.
I'm Andrew Tuck.
And I'm Robert Pound.
More from Seoul next week. Goodbye.